have a fund established by constitutional amendment than none at all. And that's kind of the way the situation developed. I do think that as far as we were concerned, it was not so much a check on the legislature's spending habits, because you never like to admit that you're a fool. But I think it was more a matter of our attempting to save what was a non-renewable resource, or what represented that, for future generations after the oil ran out.
Yes, sir.
It appears that the way the management of this thing is going to be set up is going to be pretty important. If the guy that handles it, or the board that handles it, is too independent, then there's the danger that he's going to be sort of a czar and with a great deal of power to throw around a great deal of money. If, on the other hand, the legislature or the executive has a great deal of control over it, then it's not only political, with all of the dangers of that. I'd like to ask Mr. Cooper and Mr. Gallagher what sort of planning that state legislative levels have gone into this, also what their personal feelings are about, you know, ways to safeguard against these.
A good question, Lewis. Do you want to take it first?
I'll start out. I will say that, of course, that sort of thing is one of the major policy questions that have to be decided. And you've hit it on the head. And it's going to require a lot of heads getting together and discussing various ideas. But I think that you're going to have to set up a sort of a mini check and balance system, so that the legislature has something to say in those investment decisions. The executive has something to say in those executive decisions, in those investment decisions, and so does the board. Because if you cut anybody loose and make anybody too independent, then you run into danger. And it's going to be a huge fund. The $2 billion is a lot of dough.
How about the people in the state? Should they have some rights to have a chance to vote higher and lower?
Well, I would assume, sir, that the people would be represented
with a huge amount of money. I would think I would have some opportunity.
How about a tripartite board, the executive, the legislature, and through the system of the public forums that are coming up, some means of getting the so-called consumer representative or taxpayer representative on a tripartite board?
Well, I'm sure that's being considered, and Sterling is further up on that than I am, because he has to do it every day.
The fiscal note that went with the permanent fund had $135,000 appropriated to the State Investment Advisory Committee, which is an advisory committee to me as a commissioner of revenue. And on that State Investment Advisory Board, by law, there is legislators, there's other commissioners, and there's the public on that board. And that board currently is meeting to decide a lot of these policy questions. I quite frankly see a board arising out of it, and of made up of legislators, part of the governor's commissioners, and also public at large represented on the board. When you want to talk about politics, you talk about politics, invidious sort of politics, and the proper sort of politics. And I don't think legislators and commissioners should be making should have a chance to make a specific loan or make that political decision. I think the policy decisions they should be making are the standards under which it should be invested. And I see that as a proper role of legislature and a proper role of a large board to make proper policy for the pension fund. Then it should be administered by, under those guidelines.
I just wondered if Jim had something to also add.
I would just add that one of the consultants that's been retained, Price Waterhouse, has given us a man who's been closely involved with the World Bank and development banks in numerous countries as a personal assignment for better than 2.5 years. And he feels that the key is to separate the operations of the fund from the board that sets lending policy. And among the considerations he feels that are important would be a strong executive officer who chooses his own staff and has to answer for them and can set his own rates of pay. It'll be outside the normal civil service. This way you can pay the kind of money it takes to get top grade professionals. And it's at the operating level that you review the loan and make sure all the numbers are correct, and what are the prospects of this company that proposes to start a business or expand a business, and to make sure that all of that is in order according to guidelines that have been laid down by a group that sets policy. But what you don't want to do is have the governing board picking and choosing among individual loan applications or any opportunity for contractors or interest groups out in the society being able to bend the ear of somebody on the policy board in order to get favoritism on a loan. I think that's the, and there are various ways to insulate these things. And we've only been, you know, we're only exploring this so far in a preliminary way. But.
When you really think about it, here's a place where the people decide this is as important as a decision or lack of decision with the North 12,900 million, and the aspirations of what people want the state to be in 5 or 10 years are directly focused on this, and you know, there is a public decision to be made through the legislature. And it's odd that people talk to me that at any rate, well, where's the public representation, you know, when the public is represented by their legislature. But in any event, there's a whole realm of decisions about what kind of tack the state's going to take if indeed this permanent fund does pass. And again, it's not the legislature, except in so far as the legislature makes the decision which establishes the vehicle. In 1970, it took the legislature 6 months to amend the State Investment Act. After the 900 million came, at the time of the 900 million, when we received it, we could only invest in direct United States government obligations. And the legislature, in their wisdom, took, you know, roughly 6 months to enact a new investment act, a more modern act. And by the time June came around, they'd done it. They put every conceivable kind of investment permitted in the act, and including home mortgages, right to common stocks, you name it, it's all in there. Well, why did they do it? Because the public, frankly, through the legislative process, hadn't decided. Excuse me, I'm being too gabby for a chairman.
Sure, I'd like to address a question to those in the legislature and the administration. Is the rationale, if there was one, in using the word profit making other than perhaps the word capital investments? Was it to eliminate roads, for example, which would be a capital improvement but not a profit-making improvement?
The idea was, yes, to eliminate more government spending and try to redirect the focus back out into the private sector. We think we see plenty of money in the public sector to do public things. Income producing investments, those words lock out the roads, unless it's a toll road.
What worries me is, I'll take a case in point, is a new Susitna dam proposal under the aegis of a few Western governors, including Mike Gravel, the means was established to set up the state power authority, which has been established. Now the state power authority can do the work and get the money for a dam such as Susitna, which is just a smaller version of Rampart. But we will be saddled with the costs on that. And it's going to be, everybody's going to be for power. That's a motherhood issue. We need the power on the rail belt. And there's some alternatives. There's power over on the other side of the Susitna, all the other side of Cook Inlet, a much smaller basis of power. Chugach Electric has made some studies of that. Now that power, of course, will be more limited, perhaps, I'm not sure, to the south central area rather than up here, but there must be other places. The point I want to make is, under this system, we're going to be, with these authorities, we're going to be railroaded just as the New York Port Authority and some of the New York authorities were railroaded and spending money, which was spent very foolishly and which practically bankrupted New York. So that's a worry that I have on this. How do we get these trustees who will not be taken by the PR men and the big deal of all of us that say we've got to have this magic thing called power which will solve all our problems of energy?
You're really speaking to the question of can state agencies contract debt? And of course, that's nothing new around the state. We have Asher owing $100 million, Alaska Housing Finance owing somewhere around $120 million, is it, Eric? $120 million, $130 million, maybe. And that was specifically set up in the Constitution that they would be eligible to do that. That's, I think, Section 11 here. I see that is a danger, because it really is a contingent liability in all respects, really, the state government.
And that's why I say we have to have a means of more careful consideration of how we want to spend money, how we want to change the Constitution. We got to be pretty cautious about these bright, new, happy horizon changes that we can make either through constitutional changes or through legislation and appropriation of all this money we're going to receive.
Maybe we talk about something else for a little bit, if we don't mind. And I'm curious, the program budgeting effort, which is, of course, part of the budget, the executive budget now, how is that working in your experience, Steve? I realize you're a two-year legislator, so you don't have the old system to compare it to, but I'd be interested.
Well, of course, it would work better if you had a lot more time, but the problem is that the way the legislature has set itself up for the last 2 years, the finance committees have to wind up doing darn near everything. Now, it seems to me that a more appropriate way of dividing the workload would be to have perhaps one committee studying new legislation and another committee studying the budget. And I believe if we could do that, and the finance committee could concentrate on the budget, and it would work a whole lot better than it is. As it is now, on a program budget, you see a funny-looking figure there, and you think, well, what in the world is this guy spending $40,000 a year for travel funds, and there are three people in there? And he comes in, and he says that, you know, he's got to go to the World Conference or something or others, and he paid for 18 other people to go, and that was, maybe you cut that down, and maybe you don't, but the person who made those decisions to spend the money is the person rationalizing it, and you never can get beyond him because you don't have time to do it. I think that could be remedied if we would shift the burden a bit. There's no reason for the finance committee to sit there and work 12, 14, 15 hours a day and the rest of the people in the legislature down the barren up.
Steve, how about
no reason to do that.
Steve, how about the alternate year budget thing that California is doing, where you have a 2-year budget and in the second year, the alternate year, you spend your time on budget and determine it and plan it, have more time for it, and then the other year you take the other non-budget, non-finance matters up.
I, of course, don't have enough of a background to compare the two methods. Probably most states write a two-year budget and then come in. I'm sure this was considered during the constitutional law.
Was it?
Well, maybe it wasn't. Okay,
no,
I'm wrong.
It's a new concept in California. I think it's the first state to do it. Every other year, they put up a two-year. Is that right? Every other year, they put up a two-year budget, and they give all their time to that budget, and they plan it for 2 years, and then the following year, they get into the other nitty-gritty items.
Well, possibly it might be a way to go. I don't know. It removes a lot of flexibility, of course.
I'd like to say, just an injection of constitutional history first, is that the question was considered, but obliquely from the point of view of this committee, the convention had already seemed certain to specify annual legislative sessions, which would then assume annual legislative budgets.
I made a point on that this morning, but I, as administrator of revenue, I've always felt that revenue matters got a short shift because they had to go to the same committee as the budget, and the legislature's time is preoccupied by looking at expenditure matters, and it's more happy you can do something for your constituency than going out and penalizing. So they never looked at the revenue statutes. And I think they've had inadequate review. That you look at the laws and they give all the power to the commissioner, and instead of setting out some guidelines, I've always felt that I think they should be a Ways and Means Committee, the legislature.
Jim, do you have any comments on this budget matter or not?
I am intrigued by the two-year proposal because they're with the public wish for short sessions, at least a wish, and even in a longish session, it does get very fevered in the last weeks, and we have to assume that, without making any comment on any particular item in the budget, this is a moment of opportunity for some agencies to rush things by. Even a large committee that's well staffed and working very long days and long weeks. On the other hand, there's the problem of what to do about unexpected amounts of federal aid that come in over the 2 years, and what to do about changes. Things change. Construction programs have to be altered. You might have to set up some kind of, you might have a mini budget every other year for just adjustments. That's a possibility. But it does strike a person in a staff role sitting on the edge that there would be a lot of room for some time and place to examine the work or, say, the major programs of some department at some length, instead of having to do everything across the board.
I like to speak as an administrator. I don't like to see the two-year budget, because when I come in the door right now, it's almost 18 months before I can change the direction of some program. And, that really takes away from your flexibility. When I came aboard, we haven't had a tax fraud case since 1968. It took me 2 years to get through the budget. Finally, to have a unit that could look at tax fraud sort of situations, that's a new direction for state government. But if you lengthen out to a two-year process, you might be talking about 2.5 to 3 years before you can change the direction of state government. I think that might be inappropriate.
I might add parenthetically that seems to be a lot of concern about the length of the sessions, which is something I've never been able to quite understand. But by and large, it's caused by the fact that the Finance Committee is sitting up there fiddling with the budget and everybody else is waiting to go home. And it's the same thing. If we could just split off those duties somehow or other, I think you could get home not just in 90 days, but probably less than that. And I think you could handle an annual budget. I got the same problem that Sterling has with a two-year budget. It's just, you know, there's no flexibility in there, and sometimes you just have to change your programs in midstream.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to make a very short observation. I know of no deliberative body in the world that allows the tasks of the Finance Committee or its equivalent to be spread out among other committees. Although that's the approach that I have thought most often about and inclined to most favorably. But one wonders why this never occurs. It may not simply be that we have greedy men gathered around the finance table. It could also be that it's hard to get 60 people to be reasonable about money, and that maybe these bodies have learned the hard way that you at least contain the conflict to a smaller group of people, and at least there's a better chance of getting it resolved in some kind of reasonable time frame. I think it's worth...
That doesn't mean, Jim, that you also have to have the you know, in the United States Congress, they have the committee that's in charge of intake, and then they have the one that's in charge of exhaust.
Well, I think we definitely need ways and means split off from the budget.
Yeah, so, you know, the Finance Committee's duties can be split.
That step has been taken by many deliberative bodies. Yeah. I that must be said. But I'm talking about letting, say, the Department on Labor or the Committee on Labor bore through the budget of the Labor Department and decide what's going to happen to it. And meanwhile, in another corner, the Health and Social Service people, many of whom believe deeply in all the programs of the agency, or put it another way, do not approach those programs with very much skepticism, are then given the right to decide what will happen to that budget. So you can see there are some differences.
What about this matter? It's not strictly in our area, though. It's one that's no doubt going to come up of the length of the session, and I guess your decision as delegates to abandon the 60-day territorial session?
Yes.
Was there much debate or discussion on that in the convention that comes to mind? To whether a fixed limit was desirable? Or
yes. My memory is there was a fair amount of debate both in committee, well, I was not on the committee, and on the floor, and certainly in just a general discussion among the delegates. I think the answer to the question or the decision by the convention not to limit it by law, again, falls into that general area where we made the basic decision you can't achieve good legislation by saying that it shall be 30 days or 60 days or 90 days. In retrospect, if I had it to do over again, I guess I would vote for 60 days. I see your concern. I haven't had to live with the legislature. I have not been a legislator. I don't know if that's realistic or not. I would vote for a time limit.
I suppose that I can't think of any legislator who really wants to stay in Juneau any longer than is absolutely necessary. Not even Senator Ray, who always has airplane tickets to Spain at various times in May and April. And you know, the salary's no different. And you're tired, and if you have a wife and family and dog and stuff, you want to go home and see them. And there's nothing keeping you there, I'll assure you, except that there's a task to be done.
I think the section in the Constitution on interim borrowing of state political subdivision has been a very workable section in keeping down. At least what it prevents is a New York City sort of situation where they just went into low short-term debt that turned out to be long-term.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's... was an excellent section. I've always enjoyed the legislative post-audit experience. I think the one that we have is a good system. It works well, and they get in and dig out some of our problems, and I've always appreciated their efforts, even when they attack me. I usually deserve it on those matters where they attack. So, you know, it's a good item to force you to change. And sometimes, quite often, I've used them in that I can't get anyone's attention to get it changed, so I call them up and invite them to come and visit me. And then therefore we get it out in the light, and therefore we get it changed. So it works two ways.
Does the executive branch work closely with the legislative council?
Legislative audit?
Both legislative councils, the overall legislative council that Jack Doyle heads up, and the legislative council and the audit council.
I don't think they work that closely. We have, of course, our attorney general, and we have to get by him. And once you get by him, you've usually heard all the arguments. And we each one of the commissioners probably have their own research staff in competition with the legislative council.
And do you have to have that? Of course, yeah, you have it, but why can't you work together a little more closely?
I think we try. I think the legislative council, as I found, has looked at matters that have usually anything to do with what the commissioner is doing in certain agencies. They spend quite a bit of their time, let's say this year, looking at the APUC, you know, really looking at that sort of state agency, see if it's properly constituted, and it's got the proper amount of powers.
Well, you know, on that question, each section of government having separate research capabilities, my experience is that it may look like it's wasteful, but by golly, it's an integral part of the checks and balances system. If you have to go in and argue about facts and figures, and the only source of information you have is the governor's source of information, you pretty well are under his control. And sometimes that's okay, and sometimes it's not okay. But I think that it's important for the legislature to have its own research capabilities. Very important.
In my area, the legislative research by law can't look at a lot of the things that I look at because they're all confidential. All the tax returns and things like that are confidential, and by law they're not allowed to cooperate with me.
Well, you're strange. You get everybody else.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question in a different area that might be, of interest to us here. The Constitution has been used in court under the Health, Education, and Welfare section to mandate or to direct the state's attention to its responsibility to provide secondary education in bush, remote, village areas, defined as you will. Traditionally, local school districts have provided a good deal of the funding construction of their school facilities. And I believe the state has faced with the problem, or the question anyway, under this ruling of providing physical facilities in remote areas. Now, maybe I'm not asking a question that will educate only me, but what problem has this brought up, and did the decision go to whether the receiving areas would have to do any self-financing for the self-taxing for these schools?
Well, you would be referring to the so-called Hooch case,
yes.
Well,
is it a
Well, in my opinion, the Hoots case should have been litigated. I don't believe that that the court would have found that that the state was not carrying out its responsibilities. However, that's an entirely separate question from that of whether the state, in fact, ought to provide educational facilities for those small, remote villages, just as a matter of right and wrong. The administration, as I understand it, settled the case with a decree of some sort, though I haven't seen the decree. The administration used the ruling in that case, which was not against the state, incidentally. That is largely misunderstood. Molly Hoots lost her case, but it was remanded to the trial court for other findings. The administration used that case to justify certain capital requests in some of those villages. We had the lawyers, the legal service lawyers and stuff up at the finance committee, and they had these people from the who was it, Harvard or something like that? Harvard, I think, and they had a plan for us that they, you know, for us to do. And it just occurred to us that maybe they weren't the best qualified people to be telling the people of the state of Alaska where the schools ought to go. But I do think I don't know if you can draw a line at 10 students or 30 students or 40 students, though that's very convenient to do so. But I do know that it's a very painful proposition for a child of 9, 10, or 11 years old to leave his or her home in that remote village and go off somewhere where and stay for 9 months out of the year. And it's an unusual situation. It's unprecedented in other states, as near as I can tell it. And it seems to me it's more of a moral question. That's a bad word to use in government, of course, but but it's a question of right or wrong, or whether you ought to be doing this or not, rather than following the legal ruling of that case.
Well, I would agree at your point, certainly, but there's also a companion moral question as to who pays for these schools.
I think that there is a lot of sentiment in the state for mandatory borrowization at this point in time.
Yeah. You know, the unorganized borough never has organized, so that's something I do think we have to face in the next legislature. It was batted around some the last couple of years. Ernie Haugen brought it up from time to time.
This would be a case, of course. I guess the bonds are, approach $60 million in amount?
$59 million, yeah.
Well, the people will have a chance to say we're going to provide these schools, or we're not going to provide them because we don't feel there's any local support where there should be, or we'll overlook that and go ahead.
Well, once they decide the question, they're not. If they decide in the negative, you're not sure whether people are saying, no, we don't think you should build all the schools out there in the bush, or the separate question, or should they be paying part of the freight?
Yeah, that's right. And of course, it's interesting to note that incidentally, I voted against that bill, but for a number of reasons. But it's interesting to note that some of the schools on the bond issue are in fact in incorporated school districts, and
19 million of them.
That's right. And I question the propriety of that, but anyway.
In what sense, Steve? Why?
Well, they're in incorporated school districts, and there's a rule that says that they should pay 50% of their capital financing, and this bill made an exception there. Now, where there's a school district that just can't cut it, maybe they ought to unincorporate or whatever you do. But I think a rule is a rule, and you don't say, well, it applies to Fairbanks North Star Borough, but it doesn't apply, for instance, to, I don't know, the North Slope Borough or the Bristol Bay School District. And they're just names. I don't know if it necessarily applies.
Okay.
The whole tax, state tax structure vis-a-vis schools and other public, local governmental things must be far different from what anyone thought it would be 20 years ago, with Alaska virtually paying 90% or more of the operating costs. There's no reason why we have to stay right on to the end, but there are more comments. Anybody has anything else you'd like to add? Yes, sir.
I have a comment to mention on a different subject on taxation. Mr. Walkowski made a statement here, a suggestion that I disagree with. Perhaps it's unfair to make a rebuttal when he isn't here, but I'll do it. He is mentioning about property bought up by outside interests as investments, and it was unproductive. And he suggested a method of forcing them to make it productive or to sell it would be to through taxation. That is perhaps doubling the amount or some such thing. Now, I was a member of the legislature during territorial days, and we had a big sort of a boogie here called the canned salmon industry. And most Alaskans were against it because they came up here and took our resources south and didn't pay any taxes. Eventually, of course, when the Great White Father allowed us to put on taxes, they did pay some taxes, but it was only a nominal amount. But then later, I was in the legislature when the feeling against the canned salmon industry, especially against the traps, was so great that they tried to tax them out of business. Now, I wasn't for the traps any more than anyone else. In fact, I was like put out with the idea. But I voted against this taxation measure because, to me, taxation is a for two purposes. It's to raise revenue. That's the main thing. And it is supposed to be equal. Everybody should pay equal taxes under the democratic form of government. And I just could not see that taxation should be used as a method of punishment. And so, of course, I voted against it. Now, that's what you're doing here at these you're trying to make these people put their property into production or sell it or get rid of it so someone else can by increasing their taxes. That's not equality of taxation. Use some other method, not taxation. Anybody got any ideas on that?
It brings to my mind that in the section 4 where it talks about real property and those sort of taxes, it allows exemption to be written into the law. And that rather bothers me that we allow any exemptions for real and personal sort of property. If we're going to tax that, you got a situation like New York City where personal residents are taxed at 25% of the assessed valuation, and downtown Billings are taxed at 100%. Assessed at 100% of value. And what you do are drive people out of business. And there's got to be you got to make sure there's a natural constituency there to hold on government. And what we've allowed in here is a potential danger of having an unnatural constituency arise.
What? I'd sort of question, along that line, the wisdom of using an arbitrary valuation system. I mean, there's situations, and everybody here knows about them, where somebody who's owned a piece of property in downtown Anchorage or Fairbanks for years and years, and it's their residence. And they may have paid through the years $20,000-$25,000 for the property and the house too. And, you know, all of a sudden, the commercial buildings grow up all around them, and all of a sudden they're paying property taxes based on an evaluation of, $150,000 or something like that. Well, I question the wisdom of that. Maybe that's something that could be adjusted later on. And it's also true of agricultural land.
Palmer. Mm-hmm. You might come on that. Up at Palmer, down at Palmer, the agricultural land, which has a great potential. Economically now it's not too viable, but has the potential. But it is agricultural land. I imagine you have around Fairbanks too. Is being broken up for bedroom, as bedroom communities for Anchorage. And as a result, one of the basic industry or economic base of the Matanuska Valley is being destroyed. And so attempts were being made to counteract that through taxation measures. I don't know too much about it. You want to comment on it? It was an equitable sort of a thing, yeah. a socially desirable device.
We had a bill that we passed in the House that would have provided some relief in that.
And all the Palmer people turned it down. They didn't want to lose the agriculture, but on the other hand, they want to make all the money they could through this speculative process of selling the land at high prices.
They're greedy monsters.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question, if I might, of anyone on the panel, but really, former delegates. The first sentence in the article, the power of taxation shall never be surrendered, cannot be suspended or contracted away. I'm not familiar with constitutions in other states, but as a guess, I would think that's unusual language. Why were you...
I think we find it's not unusual language. My recollection is that it appeared in one or more enabling acts before Congress again. Somebody more well versed in ancient law could answer this better than I.
Obviously the sovereign can always tax, but I just thought maybe it meant something that you were so emphatic about it right there.
No, I think it was one of those to prove political maturity, and I think it had its genesis in ancient law, and it got carried forward into many constitutions. Suspended or contracted away, except as provided in this article, then goes to section 4 that I think Mr. Booth mentioned a minute ago, or maybe Mr. Gallagher's, other exemptions of like or different kind may be granted by general law. Well, I can't remember everything that came to bear on the language in those two sections, but I can remember one facet of it, and that was at that period of time it was popular in various areas of the country and being considered, or maybe even existing in the state of Alaska, to grant certain tax concessions to industry to come into a local area for a set number of years. And we wanted to make sure, without making judgment as to whether that was good or not, we wanted to make sure that we didn't prohibit the Constitution.
Matter of fact, that was included in our commentary on the article that they submitted it to the convention.
Section 5 is an interesting section that the current reserves tax. This is the section which the current reserves tax is somewhat based on.
Uh-huh.
You can tax a right of the United States. You can do indirectly what you can't do directly.
That is correct.
Yeah.
You cannot tax the United States government, but you can tax a leasehold interest or a contractual interest in property of the United States.
It's a very interesting theory of taxation.
Yes.
I might make a sideways comment that some representatives of some of the petroleum industry have insisted that there was a some kind of deal or understanding made that there would not be further taxation on their operations in the state of Alaska. When this section is pointed out to them, they say that they don't understand it.
You find they don't want to understand it? Well, Sterling is mentioning some of these sections. Of course, sections 9 and 10 are, and 11 applying to indigenous have been the subject of several cases. Just for background information, the term capital improvements has been stared at by bond attorneys for the last 20 years, worried over, fretted over. The court decided finally that it means something of tangible value, an asset. Did determine that when a municipality could finance a manufacturing plant, so long as it ultimately got control of the plant after the lease out was concerned, it decided in the Juneau case that the city of Juneau could not acquire borrow money, general obligation bonds, to buy a piece of land to give to the state. This was at the time of the first capital breakers. So that terminology has been to the courts on a couple of occasions. I'd say Section 10 is a good article in terms of limiting the power to borrow in anticipation of revenues. And in fact, it gives you an extra year beyond the current year you're in. But again, going to your comment, Mr. White, the key, I think part of the key in New York was were there real revenues that you're anticipating, or were they mythical revenues that it just really didn't exist. That the Constitution doesn't guarantee against.
Yes, I think we had more faith then than any of us might have now in the ability of the lender to judge the intent or ability of the borrower to pay the money back.
Section 13 is not entirely clear what it means, but if you look at this provision in the light of the state loan programs as they're currently constituted, there's some question as to their constitutionality, and the section has never been tested as to those programs. Yeah. But it could be a case someday.
Apparently several things haven't been tested, Mr. Chairman, because there's an earmarked fund of 5% of renewable resources, which apparently has never gone to court. And it's fairly unconstitutional.
Great.
I would also like to comment that it would seem to me, maybe this will open up discussion, if I understand the problem, that the administration has impounded funds which have been provided by an act of the legislature, vetoed by the governor, and then overridden by the legislature. And I understand that's before the Supreme Court now, is it correct?
I don't know about that.